ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A group linked to the Al-Qaeda Islamist network is closing in on the capital of Mali in northwest Africa. This group, known as the JNIM, now controls swathes of territory. If it takes the capital, Bamako, it would be the first time an Al-Qaeda affiliate has seized national power. Dr. Tessa Devereaux from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London has been analysing the situation.
The group, when it was founded in 2017, it did officially pledge its kind of allegiance to Al-Qaeda, and it does kind of share many of Al-Qaeda's main aims, so sort of an emphasis on transnational jihad, on establishing rule under its interpretation of Sharia law, expelling all kinds of Western influence. But at the same time, we shouldn't take that affiliation as a signal that the group's under direct control of Al-Qaeda. So it is a regional actor. It operates with a great degree of relative autonomy as well. And so the other thing to remember is that it's not an armed group in itself. It's actually a coalition of about five or so different armed groups that were previously operating independently. Some of those armed groups have really strong ties historically with Al-Qaeda. Some of them are much more rooted in kind of local struggles in central Mali, for example. And I have heard rumors recently that JNIM are distancing themselves from the Al-Qaeda element. But whether that's genuine or maybe more of a PR stunt as they look to take power in Bamako, you know, remains to be seen.
Tessa, you mentioned there that it's a coalition of groups. Is there anything that resembles a coherent ideology or a coherent theology? You touched on it there. How much is an ideology or a theology its driving force?
To a certain extent, this coalition does have united ideologies. They share this commitment to Salafi ideology. They kind of aim to establish this caliphate across the Sahel, for example. They all want to expel these foreign forces as well. But at the same time, yeah, because of the nature of this coalition, there's kind of a lot of pragmatism that comes within the armed group itself. So they might side with one ethnic group in one region, for example, and another in another region. Or, you know, they might enforce very strict versions of Sharia law in some cases and not in others, for example. So they're kind of able to adapt their messages, they're able to adapt their tactics to all these different situations. And so this element of pragmatism, that's actually what makes them very powerful in a way.
Even though you've pointed out that it's not Al-Qaeda lock, stock and barrel, should this group seize power in Bamako, would this be the first Al-Qaeda allied government in Africa, if not the world?
Yes, and I think that's something that we should be taking quite seriously. They're taking inspiration from other governments recently, so in Syria and the Taliban in Afghanistan, for example. But yes, it would be a major milestone for transnationalist Islamist groups as well.
Yeah. What sort of signs are we seeing on the ground in Mali about the growing success of JNIM?
So historically, the group was very prevalent in the north and spreading down into central Mali through the 2010s. But more recently, you've seen them kind of seize control of territory into Burkina Faso, into Niger, and big chunks of territory in the south and west of Mali as well. You're even seeing attacks in Benin, in Togo, even Ghana, Nigeria. So that's very new, a sign of their growing strength and their growing coordination as well. So another one of these main signs is that the attacks have been much more ambitious, much more coordinated. So they've had these attacks on military bases. They've had attacks on foreign-owned businesses, factories, mines, all through the country. They've also managed to seize control of key supply routes. They've managed to impose blockades, basically meaning that the capital, Bamako, in Mali is really running out of fuel and other supplies as well, and really paralyzing economic activity. Then on a wider level, they're really essentially governing large parts of Mali. There are many areas where civilians are paying absolutely no taxes to the government. They're paying them directly to JNIM itself. The state's really not providing any public goods, any law and order at all. And so these areas have been governed by the armed group for years and looks like they will continue to be so.
But Tessa, how weak is the government of Mali that has allowed JNIM to grow and to be so triumphant?
Where do you start with the weakness of the government of Mali? One of the big issues is that there's been, for years, for decades, a huge amount of regional inequality in Mali. the South has really dominated politics, it's dominated economically as well, and the states really struggled to exert any control or provide any basic services up in the North or in the central regions as well. And so that's caused huge problems with separatist movements, with insurgencies, way before the arrival of these Islamist groups. To a certain extent, the Malian state has never really seized control of its full territory. At the same time, there are a lot of divides between communities in Mali, so big tensions between herders and farmers, for example, over resource access. There's massive gender inequality problems, massive social hierarchies within groups as well that stem from these legacies of slavery as well. On top of all of that, this lack of service provision has been compounded by human rights abuses from the state itself. So particularly since 2012 and in more recent years, there's been a lot of indiscriminate violence towards civilians. And so that's really pushed people into the arms of these Islamist groups as well.
Yeah, Mali once had a reputation. I wouldn't necessarily classify it as a sort of a liberal reputation, but it had a reputation as being peaceful enough for their, I think there was a world famous music festival, a jazz festival in parts of Mali. It had a reputation that put it almost on the tourist trail. This is a huge change for a country like that.
Yeah, it was kind of heralded as a bit of a success story in the 90s, maybe the early 2000s. And so then when Islamist groups took over the north in 2012, that was a big shock for the Malian state and for the international community as well.
You mentioned that JNIM has been the de facto government of some parts of Mali. What has that looked like? What has that de facto governance looked like that may be making it acceptable in the eyes of some of the Mali citizens?
The first element, and maybe the most powerful element of the governance they're providing, is justice and dispute resolution. So in many cases, state actors and also local chiefs are really seen as corrupt or they're seen as biased in some way. They treat certain ethnic groups more favorably than others, for example. And JNIM is sometimes seen as providing a kind of more fair and more impartial form of justice, of Sharia law, really. So they've been able to mediate disputes between different ethnic groups over resource access. They provide access to dispute resolution that previously wasn't there. The other thing they're able to do is implement taxation. Many people would complain about very high state taxes, very high fines in terms of access to land and other resources. What JNIM has done is do away with that altogether. They've replaced all the state taxes with their own religious tax or zakat that's paid directly to the group itself. And so this has allowed the group to control supply routes and control markets. These taxes are seen as more fair or more predictable anyway than those that were previously imposed by the states. And another really kind of important element is security as well. In this context that I've mentioned of the state kind of committing violence, indiscriminate violence towards civilians, including the role of, you know, the Russian mercenaries as well. So JNIM is said to offer some level of basic security to a certain extent, even while they're kind of committing their own atrocities. They might guarantee safe passage between different areas in Mali, for example, or protect people from banditry, protect people's cows, for example. And that can be very powerful within that context.
Yeah, but there's another even more basic reason why they may have developed some appeal. And this really surprised me because you touch on it. There are challenges among marriageable age young men and women in Mali, and this group JNIM seems to have, almost sorted it out in a way. What's that? This is a fascinating story.
It's really overlooked a lot of the time by the sort of international media. There's bride prices in Mali and it's a form of dowry. So it's paid by young men to a girl's family. And these payments are really universal across Mali and they're really substantial. So the rates have really skyrocketed recently. I think the average at the moment is about $1,500, really above the annual average income for a young man. This has really made marriage really inaccessible for large groups of young men, especially when it's compounded by institutions like polygamy as well. So older men are marrying all the young women and young men are left unable to marry and then not considered adults within their communities. They're not able to reach societal respect as well. And so what the armed group is doing, what JNM is doing, is they're offering really practical solutions. So they offer grants, they offer loans to young men directly so that they can get married. And they've also implemented bans on expensive wedding ceremonies and on expensive marriage traditions. This has made marriage much more accessible. There was actually a survey done by International Alert, and they show that 100% of women that they asked and 90% of men agree with the fact that this group has made marriage more accessible. This is a really important lever of power that the group is able to use at a local level that's often overlooked internationally.
You've warned, though, that this could be a real problem if an Al-Qaeda-aligned government takes power in Bamako, and we don't want to gloss over this. What would be the consequences? Because I'm assuming, though, that this is a violent group.
Of course, yeah, and I don't want to paint a rosy picture of what that would look like. I think if you saw Mali fall, you would see direct consequences for Burkina Faso, for Niger as well. I anticipate that they would probably fall to Islamist groups quite quickly as well. You'd see massive economic turmoil. You'd see massive migration out of the region. You would see very strict Sharia law in many cases as well. So there would be oppression of women. There would be oppression of other minorities. It would be a very difficult situation for Mali and for the area around it.
Now, while we're in the region, US President Donald Trump has threatened to intervene in Nigeria over what he says is anti-Christian violence. We have covered religious violence in Nigeria on many occasions. I'm not discounting the claims of religious violence. I'm just wondering how persistent is sectarian division in Nigeria, though, to warrant a US intervention?
There is a lot of religious tension. There's religious violence in Nigeria. The country is about 50% Muslim, 50% Christian, compared to Mali, which is 95% Muslim. And so there is growing polarization between Islamic and Christian communities in Nigeria. But one thing is to remember that the violence that does occur in Nigeria is predominantly against Muslim communities themselves. Most victims of Boko Haram, for example, are actually Muslim. Another thing to remember is that they're much like Mali, actually. There's a lot of local structural tensions over resource access, for example, and inequality. And these are driving conflicts at a base level. So much like Mali, there are tensions between pastoralist, herder communities and farming communities over access to land, over access to water. But because in Nigeria, the farmers are often Christian and herders are often Muslims, this is more interpreted as a straightforward religious conflict or an ethnic conflict. But I would say it's important to understand that there are these profound resource access issues that I would say are more of a fundamental driver of violence in the country.
Dr. Tessa Devereaux, she's assistant professor in politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. We'll put a link to Tessa's article at our website. Tessa, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.